Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next in Minnesota against Murphy. Mr. Lynn, I think you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court. The issue presented in this case is, does the Fifth Amendment to the United States Constitution require suppression of incriminating admissions to a rape murder made by an out-of-custody probationer to his probation officer because that probation officer did not first warn the probationer of his right not to incriminate himself? The Minnesota Supreme Court, in a divided opinion, held solely as a matter of federal constitutional law that the Fifth Amendment required suppression of these admissions despite the fact that respondent did not claim the privilege at the time the questions were asked. Instead, the Minnesota Supreme Court relied upon factors this court has expressly rejected in at least three cases, those being the Beckwith, Mathiasson, and Behiller cases. A state court may not impose greater restrictions as a matter of federal constitutional law where this court specifically refrains from doing so. An understanding of the legal issues in this case requires an understanding of the facts, and I would like to briefly summarize those for the court. October 1974, a 17-year-old woman is raped and strangled in Minneapolis. Marshall Murphy, the respondent in this case, was a suspect, was interviewed at that time, but was never arrested and was never indicted. September 1980, respondent was placed on probation for the crime of false imprisonment after a plea of guilty in that matter. The conditions of his probation included the normal ones, that he report to his probation officer as directed, that he respond truthfully to, be truthful to his probation officer in all matters, that he keep his probation officer informed of what he's doing. There was also a specific condition of his probation that he attend a treatment program for sexual offenders known as Alpha House. His probation officer assigned was a woman named Mara Widseth. For the following year, probationer responded in this case, and the probation officer met on a monthly basis at the probation officer's office, at times usually selected by respondent. In July of 1981, respondent left the treatment program. He was called into his probation officer's office. They discussed the matter, and she decided to allow him to continue on probation, despite the fact he was no longer in the sexual offender treatment because she felt he was doing well in other areas. Then September 22, 1981, the probation officer learned from a counselor at the Alpha House treatment program that respondent had, while in treatment at that program, made admissions or told people that he had once committed a murder several years before. When the probation officer learned that information, of course, she did not know whether that was true or false, simply that those words apparently were said. She did not go to the police to learn if any such case existed. She made no contact with any other authorities. She did, after talking with her supervisor, decide that she should relay this information she had learned to the police, and she also decided she should inform the respondent probationer of her decision. So on the 24th of September, she sent him a letter requesting that he come into her office to discuss further treatment.
Mr. Lim, may I ask a question right
there?
At that point in the development of events, could she have lawfully told the police without first talking to the probationer?
There is a problem there, Your Honor, unrelated to the facts here, and that problem has to do with the confidentiality of the Alpha House treatment program. That information was lawfully transmitted to her.
For what purpose?
for the purpose of monitoring her probation, his probation.
And wasn't the Alpha House under a restriction which would have prevented it from giving the information to the police?
It was, Your Honor, yes.
But it could give that information to her for the limited purpose of monitoring the treatment.
And reporting to the judge who was, of course, monitoring this probation, yes.
But you say there's at least a question as to whether before talking to the probationer, she could have passed the information on to the police.
There is a substantial question as to that, Your Honor, yes.
Mr. Lynn, these restrictions that you just referred to in response to Justice Stevens, are those restrictions imposed by state law?
Imposed by both, Your Honor. The Alpha House Treatment Program, this issue was litigated below at the trial court level. The Alpha House Treatment Program is subject to certain federal regulations dealing with alcohol and chemical dependency treatment. There's also a state statute dealing with confidentiality. The trial court ruled that one or both of these statutes acted to prevent that information from going to anyone other than the probation officer.
And what did the Supreme Court of Minnesota pass on that question?
They did not, Your Honor. That issue was not on appeal.
So it's not before us either?
I believe not, Your Honor.
Mr. Lynn, when the probation officer questioned the respondent, he had refused to answer on grounds that his answer might incriminate him. Could Minnesota have revoked his probation for his refusal to answer?
I believe not, Your Honor, as we discussed in our brief in this matter. Had he validly or had he claimed his Fifth Amendment privilege when this issue was discussed, it's my interpretation of the rulings, decisions of this court in such cases as Lefkowitz versus Turley, Lefkowitz versus Cunningham, Garrity, and others, that he could not be so punished. He could not be revoked for invoking the Fifth Amendment validly. In other words, that would be a valid defense. I do not believe that issue has been litigated in the Minnesota Supreme Court, but I believe in any event it is bound by the decisions of this court.
And you would concede that in making your argument?
Yes, Your Honor. In any event, then, after this letter was sent to the probationer, a meeting was set up September 28th, again at a time chosen by respondent, at the office he had been to approximately 12 times before. The probation officer began that interview by telling respondent exactly what she had learned from the Alpha House Treatment Program, that is, that he had made these comments about a murder, and that she felt he needed further treatment. At that point, respondent became angry and upset. He commented that he felt like calling a lawyer. He felt that his confidences or his confidentiality had been violated. She told him, "You'll have to take care of that outside of the office because I want to talk to you further about further treatment." The probation officer did not directly ask Murphy about this murder, did not directly confront him, never threatened to revoke him. Simply posited the position that she felt, based on what she had learned, that he needed further treatment. Respondent denied that. He did that by first denying the false imprisonment charge for which he was on probation. He claimed innocence. And he said further that at the time of this rape murder, he had been involved with drugs quite heavily, and that since he was no longer involved with drugs, the two incidents were unrelated behaviorally. The probation officer confronted him with his guilt on the false imprisonment charge, and at that point, without further prodding by this probation officer, respondent went ahead and in some detail described the 1974 murder. At that point, the probation officer informed him she would have to take this information to the police. Respondent commented that he understood that, but that unless he confessed to the police, it would simply be her word against his. She encouraged him to turn himself in. He asked for time to do so. At that point, he began to cry. He said he'd committed the ultimate sin. After some moments of composing himself, he walked out of her office unimpeded and left the building. 2 days later, the probation officer took no action for 2 days. 2 days later, respondent called and said he had contacted an attorney. He had decided not to turn himself in. And it was 2 days after that, in other words, 4 days after these admissions, the respondent was arrested, later charged and indicted with first-degree murder. The Fifth Amendment to the United States Constitution says no more nor no less than, no person shall be compelled in any criminal case to be a witness against himself.
Mr. Lynn, before you get into your argument, may I ask a sequel to the question Justice O'Connor asked you, where you said that if he claimed the privilege, he could not have had his parole revoked at that time. Supposing he were asked not about something that had happened prior to the institution of the parole, but about something that went on during parole. They asked him to report what he'd been doing and whether he'd violated any of the conditions of parole. In your view, could he refuse to answer those questions and claim the privilege and still not have his parole revoked?
Your Honor, I would make a distinction. If the questions asked had to do with conditions of, perhaps non-criminal conditions of probation, for example, if he had been drinking when he was not supposed to be.
Well, no, suppose they related to violations of law, but occurring during the period of parole. Is it your submission that he could refuse to answer those questions and still not have his, the Constitution would protect him from revocation?
That's my reading, Your Honor, of the decisions of this Court. Unless the...
Well, this Court has never addressed that question never, in a parole context.
That's exactly right, Your Honor. It may well be, and there is some case law in lower courts and in the circuit courts, that in the context of a probation officer-probationer relationship, perhaps the Fifth Amendment has no application whatsoever. At least there's some language in some Second Circuit cases to that regard. Or at least this Court and other courts have recognized that probationers, like prisoners or parolees, have a lesser right in the Fourth Amendment area of search and seizure and also in the Fifth Amendment area.
Well, is it the practice in Minnesota, you're relying on federal law rather than, is it the practice in Minnesota that the parole officers in effect have an understanding with the parolees they don't have to tell them things they don't want to tell them?
I really don't know what the practice is, Your Honor.
It's very contrary to my understanding of the way this normally works.
All I can say is that in my experience as a state court prosecutor, this issue very rarely ever comes up as to what transpired in the interview.
And what the nature of the duty of the parolee to be candid with the parole officer is. That's never comes up, never come up.
Certainly, yes, it has, Your Honor. The duty, of course, is to be truthful.
Yeah, but to be truthful. But you say that doesn't mean you have to answer any questions if you don't want to answer them. Just if you do answer, you must answer honestly. And that's the extent of the obligation in Minnesota.
I believe, Your Honor, I guess I cannot answer for the state of Minnesota because I do not believe that that issue has been addressed in our courts either. I can only deal with what is the practice and then my interpretation of case law in this court. But I do believe that if it is a valid assertion of a Fifth Amendment claim, and if a probationer has his full right to a full Fifth Amendment privilege, then he cannot be punished for a valid assertion of that privilege.
Well, are you qualifying your answer to my question, then?
Only to the extent, Your Honor, that...
By saying you don't know if the probationer has a Fifth Amendment right?
I'm saying, Your Honor, that issue... Yes, I guess I am saying that. That issue has not been expressly decided by this Court nor by the Minnesota Supreme Court.
So you withdraw your concession?
In that limited circumstance, if it is a fact that a probationer has a lesser Fifth Amendment right than others, then I would withdraw that concession. I do not know that to be a fact or not a fact. This Court has recognized, however, that the Fifth Amendment privilege against self-incrimination is not self-executing. That is, it must be claimed. If a witness under compulsion to testify makes disclosures instead of claiming the privilege, the government simply has not compelled him to incriminate himself. And the reason for that rule makes sense, that a person in the circumstances of respondent in this case, there are many factors and circumstances which may compel one to incriminate himself. Some may deal with government compulsion and some may deal with the person's own internal feelings or notions or ideas. And unless the person attempts to claim or claims the privilege, there is no way to know whether or not that individual made the admissions for reasons of his own or made the admissions as a result of governmental coercion or compulsion. This Court has recognized very narrowly limited rule or situations where one who does not claim that privilege may later assert it as a defense, and those, of course, are the inquiry here. The inquiry narrowly is, was the defendant in custody or the respondent in custody within the meaning of the Miranda case and the cases following, or secondly, absent custody, Were these admissions somehow coerced by governmental, by genuine compulsion on the part of the government? Now, custody, as defined last July by this court in California versus Baylor, means, of course, formal arrest, and it also means a restraint of freedom of movement of the degree associated with formal arrest. In the facts of this case, we have neither a formal arrest nor a restraint of freedom to that degree. The condition of probation required only that the probationer appear and report to his probation officer.
Mr. Lynch, do I gather from your last couple sentences that it's your view that the Supreme Court of Minnesota thought this case was governed by our Miranda decision?
Not precisely, Your Honor. The Supreme Court of Minnesota said, in their opinion, that the defendant was not in custody in the normal sense, but then from that position went on to identify three factors, or in the facts of this case, and expanded the rationale, if not the holding of Miranda, to cover this situation and require warnings.
I more or less read the Supreme Court of Minnesota's opinion as saying that a prophylactic requirement had been adopted in the Miranda case in the custodial interrogation arrest situation, and they were going to fashion kind of another Miranda doctrine in the parolee or probation officer situation.
I think that's precisely correct, Your Honor. That is what they did. It's half the Miranda warnings. It's the right to remain silent and the right to the warning that the evidence may be used against you, and they left off the counsel part of the Miranda warnings. And this court has never adopted a warnings and waiver requirement in anything other than custodial interrogation, as that was defined by Miranda in the cases following.
Mr. Lynn, does the probation officer in Minnesota have the power to arrest?
Probation officer, Your Honor, has the same powers of arrest as a citizen.
Is the probation officer's office located where?
It's located in the government center, Your Honor, which includes the courtrooms of the county
courts. Is it in the court building or the police building?
It's in the court building, Your Honor.
Did you say that the probation officer has the same power of arrest as a citizen?
Under our arrest statute, Your Honor, there are powers applied to a peace officer, and then there are citizen powers. They are almost all the same. A police officer may arrest with or without a warrant on probable cause. I believe perhaps a specific answer here is that if this probation officer had something amounting to probable cause or reasonable cause that a violation of probation had occurred, she could cause his arrest. Probation officers do not carry weapons in Minnesota. They do not conduct searches. They do not have any of the other powers that you may associate with the police. The trial court, Judge Lebedoff, ruling found that this defendant was not in custody within the meaning of Miranda. The Minnesota Supreme Court implicitly made that finding by not requiring the entire Miranda procedure. And I believe it is clear on the facts of this case and on the decisions of this court that the defendant was not in custody within the meaning of Miranda. There have been two lower court holdings, United States versus Miller and out of the Second Circuit, United States versus Holmes out of the Eighth Circuit, which agree with this conclusion. And it is, I presume, that in those situations, the probationer was under the same sort of probation conditions as respondent was here. So that leads me then to the second inquiry. Is there anything on the facts of this case that could be found to compel or to prohibit or deny this respondent the free choice to admit, to deny, or to claim the privilege? And I believe, as pointed out, on the facts of this case, there is no identifiable factor here which interfered with that free choice on his part. She never threatened him with revocation. She never threatened him with any sanction whatsoever had he claimed the Fifth. Since he did not, he cannot now raise it in this court. And again, that inquiry then looks further to the totality of the circumstances. And I point out briefly in that regard that the probation officer was acting in good faith in the performance of her dual role, one, to assist in the rehabilitation of the probationer, secondly, to protect the public. And she spoke with this man about treatment without threats or without coercion.
Mr. Strauss.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, the Fifth Amendment speaks of compulsion. It prohibits the use of self-incriminating statements only when those statements have in some way been compelled. Now, what's notable about the Minnesota Supreme Court's opinion in this case is its failure to identify any source of compulsion that forced respondent to speak against his will. This Court has, after all, defined a test for determining whether a confession has been compelled. The test is the familiar one, whether, considering all the circumstances, the defendant's will was overborne. But no one, neither respondent nor the Court below, seems seriously to suggest that respondent's will was overborne in this sense. He wasn't a juvenile, he wasn't mentally handicapped, he wasn't particularly vulnerable in any other way. And the probation officer's actions can scarcely be characterized as intimidating or menacing or abusive.
Well, Mr. Strauss, really, are you fairly reading the Minnesota Supreme Court opinion? They say because of the compulsory nature of the meeting, because defendant was under court order to respond truthfully to his agent's questions and so forth. Aren't they relying on compulsion when they say that?
Well, the source of compulsion they seem to identify, to the extent they identify one, has something to do with the probation conditions.
You may disagree with their conclusion, but they didn't ignore the requirement, is all I'm saying.
Well, I think they were not insufficiently precise about realizing that they had to find actual compulsion on the defendant to speak. But I think you're right, Justice Stevens.
If they construed the Minnesota probation conditions to impose a legal obligation on the probationer to answer all questions?
Well, I have two answers to that. In the first place, they didn't. But even if they had imposed that, that would simply put him in the same position as a grand jury witness who is under an obligation to speak. And it's well settled on the basis of Monilla and Cordell, the principle.
Yes, but it's not because of an absence of compulsion.
Oh, that's right. No, of course, had they construed the probation conditions to require
it seems to me that's what they're saying when they say he was under court order to respond truthfully to his agent's questioning.
Well,
not only say you have to be truthful, but you have to respond truthfully. As I read that, I thought they were holding that he had a duty to respond.
Well, the probation conditions are set out, and the probation commission requires
him to. As you know, a statute means what the state court tells it does, and I would assume state probation conditions mean what the state court tells us they mean.
I don't find in the Minnesota Supreme Court's opinion an explicit construction of those probation conditions to require the probationer to speak in every.
They apparently just thought it was rather obvious that a duty to respond truthfully included a duty to respond.
Well, the probation conditions, which after all are written in a fashion that's supposed to be understood by the probationer, say he must be truthful. That's really all they say on this point. And as the state's pointed out, to be truthful means not to lie.
They also say that if the probation officer sees fit, she can take you back to the judge. Without any more than that?
Yes, she can take him back if she has reason to believe
and
he's violating his probation.
You don't consider that coercion?
Oh, certainly not. A police officer who is interviewing a suspect with probable cause to believe the suspect has committed a crime can arrest the suspect on the spot. But that doesn't mean that the fact that he has probable cause means that he has to give Miranda warnings.
You don't think the threat to have your probation, suppose she said, if you don't confess to me now, I will have your probation revoked. Would you consider that coercion?
Oh, I think, yes, that would be compulsion.
And
that would be a very different case.
The difference, I submit, between the two is she never used those words.
Well, she never said that to him. I should say.
It was obvious, wasn't it?
Oh, I don't think it was obvious at all. I don't think the Minnesota Supreme Court so found. I should also add, Justice Marshall, that even though the situation you described, which is not this case, would constitute compulsion, I don't think it would violate the Fifth Amendment.
I would just hope that you would say there might be possibly a little bit of coercion.
I think as the term the Minnesota Supreme Court used is pressure. Now, there's no doubt there was some factors that impelled the respondent to speak. Usually when people confess, there is some sort of emotional factor involved that impels them to speak, but pressure and influence, as this Court made absolutely clear in the United States against Washington, those things don't amount to compulsion. Compulsion is the overbearing of the witness's will. And the fact that the witness was influenced by some circumstance, the fact that the state, as the Court said in Washington, created an atmosphere conducive to truth-telling, does not mean that the defendant was coerced into speaking.
May I just ask this, what is your view as to whether the probationer's probation could have been revoked if he had said, I will not answer the question?
Our view, obviously, as a matter of federal constitutional law, is that, yes, it could have been revoked.
It's different from the...
Yes, we disagree with the state on that point. There are two points to be kept in mind about the probation conditions to the extent that those are where the Minnesota Supreme Court located the compulsion in this case. One is, as the state has explained, that they did not literally require him to answer every single question. And I think, as most naturally interpreted, they didn't require him to answer every single question. I think it's fair to say they imposed on him a general duty to cooperate, but that doesn't mean that if, for example, he thought the probation officer was asking a question that had nothing to do with probation and was invasive of his privacy, that he couldn't have refused to answer for that question for that reason. And it certainly doesn't mean that he couldn't have said, I'd rather not answer that because it might incriminate me. But the second, and I think more important, point about the probation conditions is that respondent did not at any time seek either to clarify the meaning of those probation conditions or to invoke his Fifth Amendment privilege to the probation officer. Now, had he been unwilling to speak with the probation officer, he would surely have said something to her, suggesting his reluctance and asking whether he could refrain from speaking without violating his probation.
Wasn't he told to talk to the probation officer?
He was told to arrange meetings with her.
And talk to him.
And to be truthful with her.
And to be truthful with her.
That's right.
You said he was.
No, he was told those things, but those are different things from being told to answer every question, even if it is incriminating. He was never told that, and he never asked whether he had to answer every question. He couldn't conceivably have thought that just asking, do I have to talk about that, would jeopardize his probation. And it seems to me that if the respondent would rather not have discussed the crime and was really being dragged into discussing the crime against his will because he feared that his probation might be revoked if he didn't discuss it, that the most natural thing for him to have done would have been to say, do I have to talk about that?
Well, but Mr. Strauss, would that be natural if he was under the impression that the purpose of the inquiry was to make sure he was getting appropriate treatment? Wouldn't he think that the right thing to do in his own self-interest would be to cooperate with the person who's trying to help him in his treatment?
Well, that might have been a reason.
Isn't that what she told him, that she wanted the information?
Well, that I believe she did. That might have been a reason for him to cooperate.
Was he at error in relying on what she told him?
No court has found that she made any promise, implicit or explicit, that she would keep the information in confidence. And would not use it, would not go to the police with it. In fact, at the end of the interview, when she said to him, you know, I have to go to the police with this, he said he understood that was her responsibility.
If he knew, and who knows whether he did or not, what the restrictions are on the use of this kind of information at the treatment center, wouldn't he normally have assumed that he could go forward with further discussion without running this particular risk?
If there were some sort of promise given by...
Well, there's a legal promise, isn't there?
Well, no, I don't. Apparently there isn't.
Well, wasn't there a restriction on the treatment center's use of the information?
I gather there was, yes.
And didn't that restriction bind the probation officer until he repeated it to her face-to-face?
That's my understanding from the state. But that is different from there being a restriction on the information that the probation officer could give out on the basis of his statements. Had there been some finding that she implicitly or explicitly promised him that what he said would go no further and would only be used for purposes of treatment, I quite agree this would be a different case under Bram. But there's no finding. The basis of the opinion below is plainly not that there was such an implicit promise or unfairness of this sort. And I'd also reiterate, as I said to Justice Stevens earlier, that even if the probation conditions are construed as having required respondent to answer every single question, that just puts him in the same position as any subpoenaed witness And under the Mejia presumption, reaffirmed by such cases as Garner and Roberts and by the Mandujano plurality, such a witness has to assert the privilege against self-incrimination in response to a question, or he will not be considered to have been compelled to answer that question. And the reason for that rule, of course, is that witnesses are often willing to speak, even though they could be compelled to speak were they not willing. And unless a witness objects and asserts his privilege, there's no reason to conclude that he was not answering willingly. Respondent is, at the very worst, in the same position as that.
Mr. Strauss, if he did plead the Fifth Amendment, could his probation be revoked for pleading the Fifth?
As a matter of constitutional law, it's our view that it could, for the reasons that Justice Stevens alluded to earlier, and that Judge Frankel expressed in an opinion called Mandujano Manfredonia that we quote in our brief.
Mr. Wernick.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the Court. When Murphy went into that probation office, he was faced with the classic cruel trilemma. He was faced with the options of self-incrimination, or contempt for refusing to talk, or perjury if he talked falsely. His only way out...
Mr. Wernick, are you saying that the probation officer could have held him in contempt?
He was under a court order to respond truthfully to his probation officer in all matters. If he refused to do that, that would be a contempt. What I was about to say, Justice Rehnquist, was that his only way out of that trilemma would be to assert the privilege. On the question that the Court has asked whether his probation could be revoked for merely asserting the privilege, it's my position that a probationer has full Fifth Amendment rights with respect to a new criminal prosecution, but perhaps some lesser Fifth Amendment rights with respect to a probation revocation hearing.
Is that kind of an unsettled question?
It is an unsettled question, and I am analogizing to Baxter versus Palmigiano, where this Court said that if a prisoner asserts the privilege at a prison disciplinary hearing, an adverse inference could be raised at the hearing. And similarly, perhaps if a probationer asserts the privilege to a probation officer, the probation officer could draw an adverse inference, and that, along with some other fact, could be used to revoke.
To in my education, where is this case that you can be held in contempt for not answering a probation officer?
I use the word contempt, Your Honor, just because the Court has used the word historically.
Well, contempt means contempt. It doesn't mean anything else.
Well, it means what I meant to say was that he could have had his probation revoked, and the Minnesota Supreme Court so said, for refusing to discuss matters with his probation officer.
But it's not contempt.
It's not contempt. It would be a violation of his probation. I raise it that way to say that he was facing the classic Fifth Amendment dilemma. The only way out of the dilemma was for him to assert the privilege, and the issue is whether he forfeited the privilege by making the disclosure, or, in other words, did the probation officer do something, or was the situation such that he was impaired from asserting the privilege, and I submit he was because of two factors. First, because of what the probation officer told him about his right to talk to a lawyer, and second, because the probation officer continually made representations to Murphy about her concern being only treatment. When Murphy said that he felt like calling a lawyer, he said, "You're not supposed to know what I have said in treatment. That was confidential. I feel like calling a lawyer." Murphy's confidentiality rights were integrally related to his ability to assert the privilege, because if what he said in treatment was confidential, then, using the words this Court has used, then the cat was not yet out of the bag, and Murphy could still assert the privilege, and the privilege would protect him. But if what Murphy said in treatment was not confidential, then the cat would already be out of the bag and Murphy would not be protected by the privilege.
Are you suggesting, Mr. Wernick, that there's a constitutional right to keep the cat in the bag, to use your words, or is it a constitutional right not to be compelled or forced to let the cat out of the bag?
The constitutional right is not to be compelled, but where the government leads you to believe that the cat is already out of the bag, and therefore you make a disclosure, the government has misled you and has impaired your ability to assert the privilege.
What's your authority for that proposition?
That where the government has misled you as to the purpose,
because, the same thing was involved in Oregon against Mathias, and we said it didn't make any difference.
No, the court did not reach that point in Oregon versus Mathias. The only issue in Oregon versus Mathias was whether the defendant was in custody at the time, and the court said that the falsehood that the police officer had told the defendant had nothing to do with the issue of whether or not he was in custody.
Whether or not Miranda applied.
Whether or not Miranda applied, that's correct.
Well, so what is your authority for the proposition that in this particular case it would be different than Mathiasen?
Well, this case is different from...
What is your authority?
The old authority is, I guess, the first case is Bram versus United States, or is, I believe, Shotwell Manufacturing. The court has said that in the context of a compulsory proceeding, you cannot compel a person to talk by any implied threats or promises. And so I'm saying when she talked to him about treatment, for example, she was impliedly representing to him that the purpose of discussing this murder was to determine whether or not he had to go back to treatment. She represented to Murphy, Your Honor, no less than three times that her concern was treatment. She said in her letter that she wanted to talk about treatment for the remainder of his probation. When he got to the office, she repeated, "I want to talk to you about treatment. This is what I've heard you've been saying." And when she said to him, "You can deal with a lawyer outside the office, I now want to talk to you about the behavioral relationship between the false imprisonment and the murder, because I think that indicates more treatment."
Now, this is... Do you think it had something to do with the treatment problems that she was dealing with?
Whether it did or not, she is still...
Let's answer it.
Yes,
answer
it did it. It did have something to do with treatment.
So she had a right to ask that question.
No question, Your Honor, she had a right to ask the question, but she has to ask the question in a way that's consistent with the privilege against compelled self-incrimination. And she already knew that she was going to go to the police. She had that in her mind. She met with the supervisor, and that decision was made.
What reaction do you think there should be to Murphy's reference to the fact that he thought he might want to talk to a lawyer?
I think she would have to allow him to call the lawyer.
Well, that indicated he was aware of the problem.
I believe he was aware that there was a problem. Murphy testified that when he was confronted with this by the probationer, flags went up in his head. He said, "I feel like calling the lawyer." But once the probation officer then says to him, "You'll have to deal with a lawyer outside the office because now I want to talk about treatment," that prevented Murphy from making any other assertion of his Fifth Amendment rights.
Mr. Wernick, I don't read the Supreme Court of Minnesota's opinion as relying on implied representations by the probation office.
That's correct, Your Honor. In the question presented by the state of Minnesota in its petition for certiorari, they identify the fact that this was a compulsory process and that the probation officer had substantial reason to know that the answers would be incriminatory, and therefore the privilege was self-executing at that point. And this is a case where the court could reach that issue and decide whether or not, based on those two factors, the privilege would be self-executing. I am saying this case also presents itself a third factor, whether on these facts the probation officer impaired Murphy's ability to assert the privilege.
But that's asking us to make a factual finding that the Supreme Court of Minnesota didn't find.
Well, it's a legal conclusion, Your Honor, I believe, because the facts are in the Supreme Court opinion. The facts are she had intended all along to report Murphy to the police, and yet she made representations of treatment, and she told him he couldn't call a lawyer. Those facts are all in the opinion. The court said, in more general language than just limiting it to the two factors I've identified, the court said in the same paragraph, as a matter of due process, where this probation officer had already decided to report Murphy to the police, this cannot be used against him. So I think the court can affirm based on the facts that are in the Supreme Court opinion. When she told him, again, that she wouldn't let him call a lawyer because she wanted to talk about this behavioral relationship, I submit that when he first said he felt like calling a lawyer, he was worried that the so-called cat had gotten out of the bag. But when she said you can't call a lawyer, and she said because I want you to talk about this behavioral relationship, at that point it was fair of him to assume that they were only talking about treatment. And indeed, I asked the court to look closely at the confession in this case, because the confession really is an explanation of why he doesn't need treatment. His confession is, I am innocent of the false imprisonment charge. At the time of the murder, I was on drugs, and I'm not using drugs anymore. Therefore, the false imprisonment is not related to the murder, and therefore, I don't need treatment. That is his confession. Now, it was after he made the confession, the probation officer says, well, you know, I have to go to the police. It was at that point Murphy says, well, I understand that. And then he says to his probation officer, you must really care about me to have me come in and talk about this, because you could have just picked up the phone and started dialing the police. Again, Murphy was wrong about the nature of his confidentiality rights. The federal statute is clear. The probation officer could not just have picked up the phone and called the police. The language of the federal statute is that neither the treatment center nor the probation officer may initiate or substantiate a criminal prosecution based on information received from these federally funded treatment centers. So when Murphy said you just could have called the police, again, Murphy was wrong about his confidentiality rights. The issue in this case doesn't turn on whether Murphy was in custody, because she had this legal power to compel. The significance in this case...
Can I ask you, if a probation officer calls in a person on probation and says, I hear you've been out drinking in bars, and you know that you're not supposed to do that. Have you been doing it? And remember that if you refuse to answer, your probation can be revoked. And he refuses to answer. Would you say that the probation can be revoked in that circumstance, if he refuses to answer?
I would say the court raises a very difficult question there, because drinking in bars...
What's your view of it?
My view is that it probably can, but that...
It cannot, you say?
Not just for refusing...
Well, then, suppose the probation officer says, if you refuse to answer... Of course, your probation will be revoked. And the fellow says, well, I'll answer. Yes, I have. But he says, you've compelled me to answer, so you may not revoke my probation. Use this against me. What do you think he can use it?
Use his
statements against him?
I think that they...
For the purpose of revoking probation?
Yes. Yes.
So that isn't compulsion. That would not be a compelled answer.
That would be, in a sense, that, yes, that would... That would be compelled.
Yes, what?
Yes, it was compelled, but yes, it is the...
But it's not barred by the Fifth Amendment. Its use is not barred by the Fifth Amendment, even if it's compelled.
And that is because, Your Honor, the values underlying the self-incrimination clause go to protect the adversary nature of the criminal justice system. It goes to protect the nature of a criminal trial.
Well, in this case, you don't contend that... There was any physical coercion or mental coercion in this case. He finally answered the question about his involvement in this crime.
Yes.
Now, I take it that those statements could be used against him for the purposes of revoking probation.
I would say in this case they could not be used against him for the purposes of revoking probation.
Why not?
Because she told him he couldn't call a lawyer. And any amount...
Well, I know, but that all flows from... You say it isn't a Miranda case at all, do you?
Well, but it, when a government official who has power to compel an answer to a question tells an individual that they can't call a lawyer.
Well, so this is a counsel case, not a Fifth Amendment case.
Counsel is related to the Fifth Amendment, as this Court has said in Manus versus Myers. A person's ability to assert the privilege depends, in many cases, on their access to counsel.
Mr. Wernick, isn't there another factor that you may not have thought about? As a matter of Minnesota law, is a parole revocation a criminal proceeding or is it not?
I think
if it's not a criminal proceeding, the Fifth Amendment, by its terms, does not apply.
It is
apply in the, that is to use him for parole revocation purposes.
Yes, it is not an adversary proceeding such as a criminal trial. There are some due process rights which attach to it.
Well, I understand that, but is it a criminal proceeding? If it's not a criminal proceeding, what is the source of the Fifth, would the source of the Fifth Amendment assertion be with respect to parole revocation as opposed to this case, which is an indictment?
Well, Your Honor, you're setting up categories for me, which I'm not sure how to describe the ultimate label of whether a revocation proceeding is a criminal proceeding or perhaps the best word to use is a quasi-criminal proceeding.
Well, the Constitution doesn't use the word quasi. It either is or it isn't.
Well, it is part.
The point that you have to keep in mind is that the question whether the use that might be made of his answer, what might be one thing in a subsequent criminal trial and might be something else in a parole revocation hearing if that's not a criminal proceeding.
I fully agree with the Court. And if in this case, let's assume that the law is that where a probation officer uses a compulsory process to deliberately incriminate, to gather evidence for the police, that the law is that that cannot be used in a criminal trial absent some sort of advisory of a Fifth Amendment privilege. Now, the law may be is that when there's no Fifth Amendment privilege advisory, you cannot use the statement in the context of a criminal trial, but you could use it in the context of a revocation hearing. The reason I said in this case you couldn't use Murphy's statements in a revocation hearing is because the probation officer went farther than that. She completely undermined Murphy's ability to assert the privilege when he said,
What difference does it make? What if she beat him up and to get the information out of him? Said the court requires you to answer. She compelled him in every sense of the word. It still would be admissible in the civil proceeding, I would think. There's no Fifth Amendment objection to doing it unless you violated some other right.
Well, Your Honor, the Court's raising good points, and I guess in my position is that once she cuts off his total ability to assert the privilege by saying he can't call a lawyer, that it becomes so, you know, involuntary at that point that it should not be used for any purpose whatsoever.
I got the impression earlier you had more or less conceded that in the light of Murphy's remarks about a lawyer, that he didn't need a warning. A warning would have been a formality. I want to be sure. What is your position on that?
Well, my position is that after he said, I feel like calling a lawyer, and was told that he couldn't because he had to talk about treatment, that the probation officer completely confused Murphy as to what was going on in that conversation. So at that point, you know, to the extent he might have been worried about a criminal prosecution before he talked, once the probation officer told him, no, you can't call a lawyer because this is about treatment, then at that point he was confused and he thought he was talking about treatment.
You don't usually have lawyers at probation talks with prisoners, do you?
No, you don't.
I don't understand the importance of having a lawyer there.
The importance
of asking for a lawyer at the probation talk.
The importance of a lawyer is this. When Murphy was confronted by the probation officer with her knowledge, Murphy was faced with an extremely complicated legal situation.
And should have a lawyer?
Well, he felt like he needed one, and he certainly did.
Well, I'm asking, what constitutional provision requires him to have a lawyer at a talk with a probation officer?
The Fifth Amendment says that the privilege against self-incrimination can be asserted, not the Fifth Amendment, as this Court has interpreted, that the privilege can be asserted in any language. You don't have to be a lawyer to know how to assert the privilege.
Do you have a Fifth Amendment if a man stops you in the street You get your Fifth Amendment in court, don't you?
Well, but this was court. This was a compulsory process.
It was not a court.
He was under
this
court.
This was in the probation officer's office.
Your Honor?
And that is not a court.
But the court, this court has said...
Is that not a court?
That is not a courtroom. I will concede only that much.
Is it a court?
It is not a courtroom.
It's not a court.
All right, not a court.
All right.
All right. And by court, I mean courtroom, because he was still...
If it's not a court, where do you get the right to a lawyer?
He was under compulsion to speak via the court order. And when he said, I feel like calling a lawyer, I am not saying that the probation officer had to go appoint him a lawyer at that time. I am saying Murphy was attempting to assert the privilege. He was attempting to find out what his legal rights were under the circumstances. And when she prevented
him... Why didn't he ask, may I go and see a lawyer?
Murphy's testimony was that he said, I feel like I should have a lawyer present.
Did he ask for a lawyer?
Well, he said, I feel...
He said, I feel like a lawyer. Which is a,
or
I feel like I'm King Midas. That don't help you.
Your Honor, take a look at the probation officer's response and then work backwards. She said to him, you will have to deal...
I usually read forward.
Well, the probation officer said to him, you will have to deal with a lawyer outside the office. There is no dispute.
Didn't he eventually do it?
My point is that, yes, he did.
Didn't he eventually do it?
Yes, he did. But there is no dispute in this case, Justice Marshall, that the lawyer was on notice that Murphy wanted to talk to a lawyer before he talked about the murder. And the only reason he didn't do that is because the probation officer said to him, you can't.
I'd like to know if the probation officer said, all right, I'll get you the lawyer, and he got you, and you came into the room and he said to you, do I have to answer this question? What would you have said?
Absolutely not.
No obligation to answer the question.
No, because obviously the probation officer has the power to compel Murphy to talk about it, but like any other compulsory process of the court or of a probation officer...
Would you have given the same answer if the question had pertained to an alleged criminal act after the beginning of the probationary period?
Yes. Yes. A person on probation has full Fifth Amendment rights with respect to new criminal prosecutions.
No, but what if he then said, well, I want the information solely for the purpose, and I represent to you it'll be used only for that purpose, of determining whether or not to revoke your probation? Would he have a duty to answer that question or not?
I would say he wouldn't have a duty to answer that question, but that the probation officer at that point, under the authority of Baxter versus Palmigiano, and the court hasn't decided this issue in the context of probation, but that the probation officer could at that point probably make an adverse inference. In other words, if when the probationer won't talk about it, the probation officer can assume the worst.
Well, if that's true, then he might as well answer if the consequence is going to be parole revocation, and if that's the maximum consequence.
That's true if he's been assured that what he says is not going to be used against him at a criminal trial.
Well, if the rule of the employee discharge cases applies, it follows automatically that the testimony would be immunized from use at a criminal prosecution, but not from use for discharge purposes.
I agree. And when I say, by the way, that Murphy could not have been revoked just for asserting the privilege, the state of Minnesota does concede that if Murphy had asserted the privilege, there would have been a revocation hearing.
And, as a practical matter, when a person asserts the privilege, really the only option that a trier, that the person sitting there or a court, is to draw an adverse inference. If they refuse to testify, I mean, unless you're going to get out the thumbscrews, you don't ever literally, you know, compel anyone to testify against their will. It's really other devices that are used in the face of a refusal to test.
Yes, I'm not sure I follow the court's point though on that. Yeah, I mean it's nonetheless it is compulsion, whether it's physical force or not. It's compulsion. I missed the question.
Yes, but I thought you were suggesting in your response to Justice Stevens that here there was something peculiar about the fact that the remedy would have been to draw an adverse inference. And really, I think that's what the remedy is in most cases.
Yes. Well, except in a criminal trial where the Fifth Amendment prohibits the finder of fact from drawing an adverse inference. Now, I don't know how enforceable that is, but certainly the jury cannot be instructed that they can draw an adverse inference. You can't argue that they can draw an adverse inference. But in a criminal trial, you cannot draw an adverse inference. And that may be the difference, I'm suggesting, between the criminal trial and the revocation proceeding. It's an unsettled question of law. The cases that the Solicitor General cited in limiting the Fifth Amendment or in suggesting that this court should limit the Fifth Amendment rights of probationers are First Amendment and Fourth Amendment cases, where this court has said that because of the particular institutional needs of a prison system, the government can limit First Amendment rights and Fourth Amendment rights of people in prison. The precedent in this court for limiting Fifth Amendment rights of people convicted of crime is to the contrary. Prisoners are entitled to Miranda warnings when they're being interrogated about new offenses while they're in prison, and this court did assume in Baxter versus Palmigiano that if a prisoner were to be compelled to testify at a prison disciplinary hearing, then his testimony would be immunized at a criminal trial. So there is no authority for the proposition that the Fifth Amendment rights of probationers should be limited in the context of what can be used against them in a criminal trial. In identifying what the institutional
need... you still have to show some compulsion.
Yes.
And your compulsion in this case was just asking the questions along with refusing him a lawyer.
Asking the questions pursuant to a court order, refusing the lawyer, telling him that this is just about treatment, and I would add, Your Honor, that another significant fact in that regard is that at the time Murphy talked about this, he was already in violation of his probation for having failed.
Consistent with your answers to me before and to Justice Stevens, if the probation officer says to him, I just want to check up on your treatment now. Have you been taking your treatment as you were supposed to do? And the gentleman says, I refuse to answer. I won't talk about that. And I don't have to talk about it. I've been advised by my lawyer. You don't have to talk about it. And the probation officer says, I'm going to go to the judge. We're going to revoke your probation. He says, you can't do that. I've been advised by my lawyer that you can't revoke my probation. Would you say that you can revoke the probation then?
I don't believe that answer.
Just for the refusal. He goes to the judge, and the judge says, I revoke your probation because you refuse to answer. You refuse to comply with one of the conditions of your probation. You say, I take it, that you could not revoke the probation on that ground.
In that hypothetical, the judge may be able to revoke probation on that ground because it is not a crime to refuse to go to treatment.
Well, I know, but we're talking about compulsion and an answer being used to revoke probation.
But you can only assert when you're under court order to talk, you can only assert the privilege as to those matters which would implicate you in a criminal prosecution. And when
you told me a while ago that you couldn't revoke the probation if he asked him, are you been drinking at bars?
I was going to, the reason
that. And you said no, you couldn't revoke probation if he then said it's none of your business.
The issue there would be, Your Honor, whether you can assert the privilege when you're being asked about something which is not a crime but yet is a violation of your probation.
Well, that's the treatment one.
No, because she's asking him, tell me about this murder.
I'm in my example. I said, he just asked him about treatment. Are you taking your treatment?
Right.
And he says, none of your business. You think that... treatment could be, or probation could be revoked then.
If the Fifth Amendment only protects against further criminal prosecutions, then the answer to your question is he could be revoked because he has no basis to take.
Similarly about drinking at bars.
Similarly about treatment at bars, but differently about being asked if he's committed other crimes.
Well, then there, in neither case, I would think, would there be compulsion.
In both cases, there may be compulsion. Maybe some compulsion, but...
Well, there must be. You have to say there's enough to...
Your Honor, the government can compel...
You have to say there's enough compulsion to keep it out of a criminal trial.
There is nothing illegal about the government compelling information. The government does it all the time. It must do it It must compel information in order to function, but it has to do it in a way that is consistent with the Fifth Amendment. And when Murphy says, I feel like calling a lawyer, and when she tells him he can't, and when she deceives him as to the nature of the interview, she is not conducting herself in a way which is consistent with protecting the values underlying the Fifth Amendment. It seems to me, Your Honor, all parties in this case have agreed that the most important institutional need of the probation system is a trust relationship between the probationer and the probation officer. And if this court puts its seal of approval on the conduct of the probation officer in this case, then that institutional need would be undermined, and I ask the court to affirm the judgment of the Minnesota Supreme Court.
Mr. Lynn, do you have something further?
A few points, if I may, Your Honor. As to the issue of the mention of a lawyer in this conversation on September 28th, the constitutional right to a lawyer arises in only two circumstances that have been recognized by this court. That's the in-custody, Miranda type of interrogation, where the request for a lawyer is viewed by the prophylactic rules in that decision to affect the protection of the Fifth Amendment right. The only other situation is at a critical stage of a criminal proceeding, and that is the true Sixth Amendment right to counsel. Neither of those two situations applies to a probation interview generally or to this one specifically. And secondly, just to reiterate my major point, the privilege in the Fifth Amendment does not prohibit asking questions or asking criminative questions. It only prohibits the government from compelling self-incrimination. And the focus of that inquiry has to be on the words and deeds and actions of the governmental agent in this particular case. There are either individually or in combination, there are not factors identifiable here in the conduct of the probation officer which could be found under the existing decisions of this court to compel his answers in the sense that he did not have the free choice to admit, to deny, or to claim the privilege.
Mr. Lynn, what if Minnesota's parole conditions were a little less ambiguous? Because apparently there's some argument about what they really mean. Supposing they said in so many words, every probationer has an absolute duty to respond to every question propounded to him by the probation officer truthfully, fully, in all detail, concerning conduct during the probationary period, and the failure to respond to any such question shall be grounds for revocation of the probation. Would there be any constitutional objection to that?
I do not believe so, Your Honor.
And why? But you don't construe your — you do not construe these parole conditions to require any such broad duty to respond, as I understand your argument. And I would think most the interest of the parole system would be served by maximizing the flow of communication rather than by creating situations where you've got to claim privileges and all the rest.
I would generally agree with the court. On the facts of this particular case, however, there's a problem in
that. Well, the problem because it relates to antecedent criminal conduct.
Exactly.
Which is, but if it weren't for that, well, I guess we understand.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted. We'll resume at 1 o'clock.